Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
So we kind of told the story the best we could in sort of a roundabout way in the first episode. And this episode, let's pick up some of those pieces and really talk about where these stories have intersected primarily with Mormonism. One thing I wanted to bring out, maybe I'll just ask you, Alan. We're going to focus on Mormonism, but Mark Hoffman's career was in Americana too, just the whole American history documents. Who are some of the famous names and signatures and documents that Mark Hoffman? This is just to show
he
the scope of his career.
He did forgeries with using the names of famous Americans, Betsy Ross, Jack London, Lincoln, people like that.
Daniel Boone.
George Washington.
So sometimes he found a document that was signed Betsy. It was a letter. And it was dated 1837 or something. And he changed one number maybe to a 3 and then put Ross at the end of Betsy. And now it's a Betsy Ross. He got a copy of Call of the Wild and put an inscription in there from Jack London and his dog Buck. And he wrote a poem. I think it was an 8-line poem by
Emily Dickinson
that was good enough poetry to be considered an authentic Dickinson poem. Now, whether he copied it from another time period piece by some less known author is unknown, or whether he actually composed the poem, I don't know. But he was getting into Americana, and this Oath of the Free Man would have been the really famous piece. And the question is whether he was trying to eventually change American history, whether he would have done what he did with Mormon documents, have sort of innocuous content initially and then gradually change our view of the Revolutionary War or how the Declaration of Independence came about, whether these guys were inspired or just greedy or, you know. I don't know about that, but I think there is some sense that he definitely was trying to change perspectives on Mormon history. And one thing we haven't talked about is the 116 pages of the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith, when he began translated, did an initial set of 116 pages, and they were handwritten by his scribes. And Martin Harris, one of the early church leaders, was one of those scribes. And his wife, Harris's wife, became displeased at all the time that Harris was spending with Joseph Smith working on the Book of Mormon project. And so she asked Harris to get some proof of what he was doing. And so Harris went to Joseph Smith and said, I'd like to borrow these so I can show them to my wife. Joseph Smith was extremely reluctant to do so, but eventually succumbed to the pressure, let Harris take these pages. And he did show them to the wife, and then they disappeared. And we still don't know what happened to them. Well, they've never turned up. So when the police got into Mark's workshop or lab, they found some pages that it turns out might have been his drafts or early versions of some of the lost 116 pages. The value of them monetarily would be incredibly great.
Yeah.
And he could have sold them off a page at a time or half a page at a time. But the interesting part was what these pages said, and they dealt with Lehi and Nephi. This is the early part of the Book of Mormon, and portrayed them as treasure seekers and money diggers, gold diggers, and so forth, which was how he was portraying Joseph Smith as well. So I think he was not only secularizing Joseph Smith and making him less divine and more human than the church portrays him, but probably doing the same with some of the Book of Mormon characters. And so had everything played out for another year, it would have been interesting to see what he produced in terms of those pages as well.
Yeah. And didn't he say that he was, at first he said he wasn't trying to change Mormon history, but then he reversed himself and said, well, maybe I was trying to, but he said that he thought he wanted, it should conform to what he thought really happened.
Right. Yes, he did say that in his debriefing with the police.
Yeah. Right. And part of that is because his stuff did resonate. That was some of the reasons that these forgeries were so good, weren't they? Because historians sort of knew that Joseph Smith was you know, certainly into folk magic and treasure digging
plausible.
And all that stuff. They kind of sensed it, but certainly nobody, it hadn't officially gotten out in any kind of deep way, the extent of it. And so Mark produces, let's start with the Salamander letter. And maybe some of our listeners are even wondering why your book was called Salamander at the first. This is one of those documents. Why don't you describe it for us, Alan? And the timeline, and I know Steve Christensen was involved with this, so right. Kind of locate that letter for...
The Salamander letter is another name for Martin Harris to W.W. Phelps letter. Martin Harris was one of the original witnesses to the Book of Mormon, an early church leader, a pretty important figure. And W.W. Phelps was a literary figure in the early church. And it describes... Joseph Smith's seeking the gold plates and turns the story on its head because the official version, and by the way, there are several different accounts of the first vision. I think some people have numbered them as high as 9. Jim Allen, a church historian, wrote an article in the Ensign magazine that covered, I think, maybe 6 of them. But there are several different accounts. They're all similar, but the early ones are shorter, less detail, and the later ones more dramatic, more elaborate, and slightly different detail. 2 people, 1 person, 3 people, things like that. So the original, the official version has Joseph Smith encountering this angel Moroni, who is actually one of the characters in the Book of Mormon, the last living person and the final writer of the Book of Mormon, who ended up in New York, where the plates were then buried by Moroni. And so instead of, in the Salamander letter, instead of Joseph Smith encountering Moroni, he encounters a white salamander. And there are some references to enchantments and things like that, too.
And that's in the hole where the
plates are. So the plates are buried. He opens up, takes the cover off the stone hole where they're in, and the plates are there, and there's this white salamander. Why a white salamander? Well, those who researched it later find out that that was a symbol. Sometimes it's a divine symbol. Salamanders are known not to burn in fire. They were believed mythically not to burn in fires. So you've got these companies that sell what they call salamander safes. I mean, obviously salamanders do burn, but it was thought that they didn't. And so instead of this divine creature, you've got this magical, it's white magic coming forward. And people like Leonard Arrington, other historians, thought it was a plausible story. Thought that they weren't shocked at this as much as common members would be shocked. And again, it downgrades the Book of Mormon Genesis story from a divine angel to a magical figure, and that's a faith-destroying or faith-challenging thing. This was just one of many. The Josiah Stoll letter, which is nicknamed the money-digging letter, same thing. It portrays Joseph Smith as a professional money-digger who would use propitiations of chickens and incantations and peepstones and hats and other white magical means to find buried treasure, Spanish treasure or maybe Indian treasure buried in these mounds that were all through the New York area.
And that was also one of his forgeries.
Was a forgery, and this is one that he went to Gordon Hinckley to directly. Gordon Hinckley was a counselor in the church presidency. Ezra Taft Benson was actually the church president, but Hinckley was effectively running the church because of Benson's age and frailty and
as well as his counselors,
Mark I guess dealt with him directly, and Hinckley purchased the document and then it went into the vault, and Mark had promised never to disclose its content or you know, but in fact he had made a typescript of it and circulated it around. I got a copy of it. I'm sure you got a copy of it. So Mark was playing both ends. I mean, he was circulating and creating a controversy, and then promising President Hinckley that he would sell the church the letter and it would never be known of again. And you know, he was having his way both ends. Mm-hmm. So those were some of the things that would the content of those documents. Brought into question the traditional story of the beginnings of Mormonism. Joseph Smith's divinity, the divinity of the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith being portrayed as a money digger. Well, the fact is that he had a career doing that. It's well documented. He was arrested and brought to trial some 26 times for a variety of alleged crimes, some of which had to do with this money digging career he had, where he took money from people like Josiah Stowe, but never did find any treasure. So they considered it, you know, kind of fraudulent representation. So Hoffman thought, well, that's who Joseph Smith was, so I'm just telling the truth about who he was, and the historians that are well-versed, like Michael Quinn, would know that this is in fact true, so it shouldn't raise that many red flags with them. But the members, of course, would be challenged by this kind of thing. In fact, Linda Newell and Val Avery, in their book on Emma Smith, they quote Hoffman documents would turn out to be forgery. Al Rust's book on Mormon coins and currency had 6 or 8 different currencies and coins that were forged by Hoffman. Yeah. And many, I myself had given a paper on the Salamander letter and the money digging letter to the Utah Westerners, a scholarly paper analyzing the content and all the historical context and what did it mean for the church. And I didn't know they were forgeries at the time. Fortunately, I didn't publish that paper anywhere. But already Mormon history was being changed by actual printed books. And Hoffman's philosophy was, and he stated it, having to do with the mint mark on the coin. He said once he sent it to the treasury and they authenticated it, then it became an authentic, coin. And it
so if everybody believes it's authentic, it's authentic.
Yeah, I wrote a dialogue article called Truth is the Most Important Thing, because that's a quote from him. And he basically said once a document was authenticated, even though it was forged, it became a true document. And then if it's quoted, that became the new truth. So he was, in effect, creating new truth through forgeries, which were based on old truths with some lies mixed in as well. Mm-hmm. I think he was having a great time manipulating church history and making a lot of money doing it, and maybe he would have done the same for American history. Who knows?
Let's talk about a couple more famous of his forgeries too, and then let's really talk about how that has.
What does it all mean?
Yeah, let's talk quickly about the Joseph Smith the Third blessing. This is another little angle in Mormonism that there's rumors of something. Versus, do you want to tell it, Kurt, or should we turn it back over to Alan? What the Joseph Smith III letter was all about. Or not the letter, that was the blessing. Was it the blessing itself?
Yeah. Go ahead. It doesn't matter. Joseph Smith left, according to Michael Quinn, an article that he wrote, 8 different succession possibilities for if he were to die, who would take over the church. One of them was, the head of the Quorum of the Twelve would, Brigham Young. And then there were all of these others. He was very unclear about it, or let's just say he let lots of possibilities be out there. So there was quite a fight after he died for control of the church. Lots of people stepped forward and said, I'm the legitimate heir, I should take it over. Brigham Young went out over these others. But one of them was that his oldest son, would take it over, so it would stay in the Smith family. Well, what was then known as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they subscribed to that option. They felt like Joseph Smith made it clear it should stay in the Smith family, but they didn't have solid documentation for it, and there was contrary documentation going the other direction. So Hoffman comes up with this Joseph Smith the Third blessing, which was a blessing by Joseph Smith to his son Joseph Smith the Third, essentially anointing him as his successor as the president of the church. Well, when the reorganized church heard about this document, of course, this validated their claim and made them look like the true church based on this. And so, of course, it had to be authenticated and all of that. And then who should own it and what was the LDS church going to say in response. So it was very controversial as well.
And didn't Mark sell it? Or attempt to sell it to both without the other one knowing that he had made the offers and stuff.
Yeah, and he could work both ends. He could say to the Utah church, well, I'm going to let the other guys get it. They're really pressuring me. They think they should be the ones to own it. They're going to offer this big amount. And then he could go over there to Independence and say the same thing to them. The Utah church would really like to have it and dismiss it.
The LDS church ended up with it.
Yes.
And then to get it, the RLDS church offered to trade an original Book of Commandments, which was a very valuable, rare book, for the blessing, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole story that comes out of that later, but that has to do with me, but it's not pertinent to this. But it was valued at about $20,000 for. And for that period, that was an enormous amount of money. It still is, but...
Yeah, but now a Book of Commandments would get $1 million, right?
Or more, yeah.
And just for the listeners who don't remember, this is when the printing press was destroyed and these leaves were flying all over when the mobs came. And this was the two sisters who gathered up the leaves, and they were only able to assemble... Right. They were only able to assemble...
Yes, a very limited number of copies.
Fewer than 30 or something, right?
Yeah, about 30 copies. Yeah,
so a couple more, just again to give you the scope of the different things he's doing, and again to make the point of Mark Hoffman, you know, forging documents that fit a truth that he believed was perhaps more accurate than the church's, you know, sacred narrative about origins and things like that. There's two more that I thought we'd talk about for sure. One is a letter from Carthage Jail. Supposedly, that challenges the last letter that Joseph Smith wrote, and instead of like a lamb to the slaughter, is basically Nauvoo Legion, come get me, right?
Basically, yeah.
Written to Jonathan
Dunham, who was the head of the Legion, and yeah, basically that was it. Come and rescue us. Yeah.
It's known as the Dunham letter,
right?
And there's a lot of back and forth on that, the dealings for that letter as well.
Yeah, it's pretty complicated.
But another one, where he's tweaking the story in a plausible way,
right?
But not necessarily in line with the sacred story version.
Right. And the one of the key factors about that is it played into the whole story toward the end was the enormous amount of value given to it, and I was involved with that part. It sold for ultimately $100,000, and that gets complicated too, and there's twists and turns to that story, but that was the highest amount of money ever paid for a Mormon document. And that was, of course, one of his creations as well.
Yeah.
And
in our book, we call it Joseph Smith, the Jonathan Dunham letter, dated 27 June 1844, purchase price $60,000,
the first purchase price.
Yeah.
It later resold.
And then there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 7 different tests that were done on this letter, which was more tests than done on most of them. And it was positive for forgery on all but one of the tests. So there were several things wrong. The blue haze, the unidirectional running of the ink, the bleed-through of the ink, the alligatoring, solubility.
None of which we've explained at this point.
But there's a whole forensic end of this story that we're not going to deal with. Okay, one more letter, or one more document, again, just to show a way of shaping Mormon history that he had. And this would be a land deed that bears two names that are Solomon Spaulding, and maybe our listeners have heard of the Spaulding theory of Book of Mormon, you know, influence on the Book of Mormon, and the other name is Sidney Rigdon. And this is a land deed document that has notaries,
dated 1822, it sold for $400. Introduced in 1985, July, so just before the bombings. And what the significance of it, of course, is that it links Solomon Spaulding, who really challenged the authenticity of the Book of Mormon, and Sidney Rigdon, who was an early great religious influence on Joseph Smith and a member of the church and an early church leader. And it puts together these two guys. It's dated 1822, so this is
before
Joseph Smith gets going in his career at all. I mean, Joseph Smith was born in 1805, so he would have been 17. So it shows that, I mean, again, it brings into question whether Spaulding was gave ideas for the content of the Book of Mormon. Just like Ethan Smith in View of the Hebrews. I mean, the secular theory is that Joseph Smith made up the book from source material that he had available to him. And Dan Vogel writes in his book about the Book of Mormon and American Indians that there were like 40 different other sources with the story of of Jews coming across the ocean to South America or Central America and then becoming the Native Americans. And Joseph Smith could have picked that up from any number of places. And so this land deed, which seems insignificant in itself, just because of the two people that were party to it, then makes that Spalding theory a possibility.
Yeah, I'm going to provide for you the missing link that shows these two men knew each other.
Exactly.
And associating.
And that actually was one of his sloppier forgeries. Mm-hmm. The date was obviously changed. And I think that's exactly what he was trying to do, is establish that link, but I don't think it ever played a huge role.
It didn't. It wasn't known by people, and the historians weren't even really talking about it. So
it was proven to be a forgery before it really had a chance to gain some traction.
Exactly.
and stuff. Okay, great. Well, anyway, that's just to kind of give the flavor to our listeners here of the Mark Hoffman, subversive of at least the official Mormon claims, providing historians with these tantalizing documents that were certainly plausible within what they had known and sort of knew that there was a more complexity there. And so Mark, in many ways, was playing right into their hands. So let's talk about that. How has Mormon history and the types of questions and the shaping of the story that we now tell compared with what we did then, how has the Mark Hoffman affair sort of been a spur to the new Mormon history, let's call it?
Well, one of the interesting things that happened was during the time of these events, the finger pointing that started. Some of the attorneys for the prosecution, the county attorneys and so forth, were making verbal accusations, basically saying that the Mormon historians were responsible for Hoffman getting the idea for these forgeries, and that this kind of new Mormon history that was coming out that was exposing some of these traits and backgrounds of Joseph Smith as money digger, for example, stimulated Hoffman to create the forgery. So there were some blames right at the beginning. Then church leaders, I think, were also putting blame on Mormon historians. This golden era, the Arrington era, this idea of not just having faithful history but having an objective, accurate history, that attempt was then, I think, thwarted somewhat, and the Arrington era came to a close, and he ended up down at BYU, and the history stuff went to BYU instead of being in the church office building, and his picture was taken off the wall, and he was told that he never was really the church historian, despite the fact that he was actually brought before the General Conference and
sustained
as such in conference. And then the 16-volume church history that Arrington and his group had planned, that project was canceled. So there was
you could draw a direct line.
There was immediate impact, okay. I think. And so it's one thing to say you guys shouldn't have endeavored to write these kinds of histories, look what it created. I don't think it's fair to blame them for what Hoffman did, frankly, any more than it's fair to blame President Kimball or President Hinckley for not discerning that the documents that they had in front of them and the dealer that they had in front of them was a crooked dealer and forged documents. I mean,
let's deal with that one in a minute.
Of those things happened before. I mean, the cancellation of that, the history came long before the bombings, and Arrington left in 82. So
3 years before.
Yeah, these okay.
Three so, so you're right. You're right.
So you're saying from the end, the side of the church, there were people that were already nervous about the story that was emerging.
It was confirmed. The things that Kurt mentioned happened in 82 was just confirmed. I think the church leaders felt validated. And their decision, because here's another example of history faith conflict exploding on us, and the fact that Hinckley bought documents directly without telling anybody, that came up in a church PR conference or a PR press conference. I don't know if you read about that, but there were a couple of different ones. The one I remember the most is when Jerry Cahill and Wagner, what's the other guy's name? Lindsay Wagner, no.
Oh, Robert, no, not Robert Lindsay. He was the author.
Robert, no, right.
Bruce Lindsay?
Bruce Lindsay's father.
No, no. Oh. Anyway, there were these church PR guys, and they were asked in an initial press conference about the money-digging letter, and they basically denied that the church knew anything about it. And then Hinckley had to come by later and say, well, actually, I do know about it, and I've been dealing with Hoffman, and I purchased it, and we own it. And so the second press conference, other questions like that came out, and I remember Jerry Cahill saying, when he was asked about another document, I don't know, and I'm not going to find out, which is an unbelievable statement for a PR guy to say. But it was causing internal difficulties as well. The right hand and the left hand didn't know what each other was doing, and that's because of the secrecy involved with obtaining these Hoffman documents.
Okay. Well, and we know that there were some documents, but I think people get the wrong idea and think that this was happening on wholesale in large numbers. The church was just
it only happened a few times,
and that was very unusual. It was not according to the usual procedure, but it wasn't this picture that some people have painted, that the church was just acquiring documents by the score and salting them away, never to be seen again. I mean, we do know that there were a few transactions like that, but I think it's unfair to say that there was this big conspiracy to hide all of our history and to not let anything out. That was because, you know, the atmosphere was already changing. There was more openness, especially under Leonard Arrington. And so, you know, I think it creates the wrong impression to think that church leaders were involved in some vast conspiracy. And there are even wilder accusations that have been made that are just unfounded.
So, but it only takes one example to create that impression and to start the rumor mill, and the document, the Josiah Stowell money digging letter, was a significant document, and that one example alone, and I think there were really maybe only two or three total where they did that.
Right.
The rest of them they vetted through the church history guys or through owners who, and Hoffman would often offer to share the cost of authentication, which gave him more credibility.
Right.
You know, if it's not authentic, then I won't sell it to you. And if it is, then I'll split the cost and you can have it. And
The only thing I'm pointing out is the exception rather than the rule.
I think that's legitimate. But that exception became kind of a sticking point, I think, with people.
Right.
It's a big one. All right. So the three main, would you guys agree, and we're kind of, I don't know if we want to get into that particular one more, but the three main claims that have come out of the Hoffman thing is in terms of, you know, real negative PR for the church are this one that you guys are just now talking about. We're purchasing documents and deliberately hiding them from our people. We don't want the sacred narrative that we've spent 175 years building up as the truth, the Sunday school version of stuff. We don't want that to be complex. We're not denying that this is an authentic document, but it just, our members are too tender, or what are they trying to do? They're just trying to protect the membership of the church from the truth. So that's one. Let's deal with the other one of how on earth can these guys be claimed to be prophets of God and to have dealt with this guy over and over again, and their power of discernment wasn't on in terms of the documents go, or wasn't on in terms of I'm basically dealing with an immoral, you know, black-hearted deceiver right here, you know, the snake in the garden kind of thing. Lay out what you've heard, either one of you, on that.
Well, I've been asked
what's the scope of the claim.
After the book came out, even before, when we started doing more articles for Utah Holiday, we started being invited to speak all over the place about this. Linda and I, sometimes we'd speak together, sometimes separately, especially at universities, and that question would come up all the time from faithful members. And I don't think we wanted to be in the position of representing the Orthodox point of view, really, or defending the church leaders. But my own thought would be that Joseph Smith said, and President Kimball said, and others have said, that a prophet is a prophet when he speaks as a prophet. So this idea that the power of discernment should be on 24 hours a day, and that they're in constant communication, even the church leaders themselves don't claim that for themselves. So it placed an unrealistic expectation on them to think that they could always know every bad thing that happened. I just think that they define the role of prophet much more narrowly than that. Even the Pope, you know, he's infallible, but the rest of that line is in matters of faith and morals. Well, that doesn't have to do with what he eats for breakfast, Cheerios versus Wheaties, or any number of other things that are their normal secular lives. So I think people who were stunned by that probably put unrealistic expectations on their church leaders and ones that the leaders didn't claim for themselves.
The founder of the religion, Joseph Smith. I mean, he was not always the greatest
judge of character.
Yeah. I mean, he chose John C. Bennett to be, his right-hand man, and he turned out to be quite a scoundrel. And
he couldn't discern the Kinderhook plates.
The Kinderhook. I mean, first of all, I believed this for a long time, that before we're anything else, we're human. We are limited in our ability to figure things out. Sometimes we know we're flawed and we have foibles. And but I would like to weigh in on this because I, along with so many others, was completely taken in by this man who had an uncanny ability to fool people. And the church leaders admitted, Gordon B. Hinckley admitted, that they were duped as well. And one thing that Dallin Oaks said at a symposium after all this came out and the church finally started to speak up on some of these things, he said that they, as church leaders, approach people on the basis of trust, and unless they know there's a reason to not trust someone. Well, that's the way I conducted business, and that's the way I've conducted my life. That unless someone shows me a reason that they can't be trusted, I generally do trust them. Yeah. And I totally trusted Mark. But
and you mentioned in Salamander, at least you're quoted Salamander, there was no, in Mormon document dealing history, there really was never any forgeries before this that anyone knew
about. Right, this was all new territory.
It's not even on your radar screen.
That's exactly right. We had no reason to think that anything like that was going on or could go on, really. I believed Mark when he told me things because he had already been established as a credible source and as an expert and so on. When he approached church leaders or anyone else, they looked at it the same way, that here's a proven quantity. He's, you know, and he generally, quite often, would follow through on what he said he would do. And but I feel like I'm in good company having been taken in and duped by him, because he did the same thing to everyone, including his wife, his parents, church leaders, everyone around him.
Even professionals, the Antiquarian Society, the Smithsonian, the FBI lab, all of those professional groups, the Rendell and Hamilton, the forgery detectors, they were all fooled. The businessmen that he dealt with, they were fooled. He gave forgeries away as Christmas gifts, you know, Books of Mormon with, you know, Brigham Young signature. They were fooled. Like I said, he was an equal opportunity con man. He got everybody.
Yeah.
He got everybody.
Well, and so the question still is in some minds, why couldn't they, with this special spirit of discernment, see through him? Well, because they weren't looking for anything like that to begin with. And I don't have that same model in my mind that people are given these, how would you put it? I guess it's a supernatural gift, but I think that we
are just at least
largely,
10 times heightened over the average person's.
I think we're largely left to our abilities to judge character, and I don't think they turn on that filter when dealing with certain individuals to see if they're, you know, telling them lies, or certainly they weren't going to be thinking that he was a forger or a murderer or anything like that. So I cut him a lot of slack because he fooled everybody else, and I don't think we should ascribe to these men abilities that people generally don't have, or at least function most of the time.
Well, let me just ask, again, I don't necessarily disagree with either of you guys, so let me just ask a question that I know that a certain segment would then say, well, then why don't they do a better job of at General Conference and stuff of reminding us over and over again that these guys are men, instead of we're special witnesses of the God, the uniqueness of the Mormon claims, you know, this is Jesus Christ's church. That rhetoric sets up these expectations, and so is it fair to blame somebody who's lost their testimony or something over it when the church has contributed to the rhetoric that they had bought into, and therefore now felt completely betrayed when they learned that these guys couldn't see the snake for what it was.
No, I don't think it's fair to blame members who have lost their testimony. I don't think it's because they were weak. But I think the issue comes down to the problem in the church of history and faith. When you go to testimony meeting, members bear testimony of historical facts being true, but they weren't around when those events occurred. I know Joseph Smith saw an angel, and the Book of Mormon is an ancient document, and I know Joseph Smith did this and this and saw God, and they testify as true to things that they weren't around to see. So they're actually saying what they believe. They're making statements of faith and belief, not truth statements. But people mix those two together. They combine them. They assume that their beliefs are true. And so the church, Joseph Smith said the Book of Mormon is the most accurate and true document there is, and
most correct book,
most correct book, and you can test the church using the Book of Mormon as the test stone. And so when you find out that it's not an ancient document, that is faith shattering.
Well, if you come to that conclusion.
Well, but that's the conclusion, yeah.
Mark Hoffman.
I think Mark Hoffman was pushing toward. He was trying to, and the fact that people have lost their testimony because of the lack of discernment of church leaders probably makes him happy in a way, because that achieves a goal he was trying to do through the documents. If the church archives have been limited, or if church historians have been punished unduly as a result of this, if they've gotten the blame, I'm not sure he's real sad about that either, frankly. But that's, you said there were three things, and you mentioned two of the three. Yeah, I thought maybe the third one was, well, what about how responsible are the historians? And is a limitation of the archives fair? Is it limited? In fact, has it reduced Mormon studies in some way?
As well as has it spurred it in some ways?
Yeah, I think that.
And I would argue for that as well.
I think it's both, actually. I think an immediate outcome, though, was the church historians were painted with a black brush, and I think the archives were more limited for a time. But I think more recently they've been more open.
Now they have a new
building. And frankly, I have to say I'm quite impressed with the new book by really Mormon historians on the Mountain Meadows Massacre. A lot of people thought that book, which followed Will Bagley's book, Blood of the Prophets, would be kind of a self-censored, controlled, because the church came out. The church had Richard Turley came out with a book on the Hoffman story. I read a draft of the book before it went to press. I haven't read it since it came out.
Victims.
And, trying to essentially portray the church as the biggest and most important victim in this, and not complicit in any way, which I think is... And it's a big, thick book full of footnotes, and they had access to things that we didn't have access to, and nor did the other authors of Hoffman books have access to. But it was a sort of a self-defensive book, this Mountain Meadows Massacre book by three Mormon historians, I think is more open and more honest and more self-deprecatory and self-blaming than the Hoffman book was done, the victim's book by the church.
Well, and none of us could have predicted that such a book would be produced. I'm referring to Massacre at Mountain Meadows that he's talking about. I would have never thought that three who were employed by the church would be able to produce a book like that, and I think it shows that there have been enormous strides in openness and
especially
trying
lately.
To deal with our history, because there isn't any blacker event, if you want to put it that way, in our history, darker. And the fact that they were able to paint that in such an accurate way and that doesn't try to vindicate the church in any way, that's quite an enormous change. It's a sea change, in my opinion. And we're seeing more and more of that kind of thing. The Joseph Smith Papers Project is another example. And I think you're right, Dan. I think in some way, I think the whole Hoffman legacy has helped lead to more openness and an expansion of our desire to dig deep and to bring out the history and all of its richness as well as some of the warts.
Yeah, one of the points we might make along those lines is obviously Richard Bushman, who was assigned to do one of those 16 histories under Leonard Arrington's thing, resulted in the book Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism,
right.
which came out the same year as the bombings, and it had quite a bit of the a little more openness about the folk magic and the extent of that. And then immediately after the bombing is, and didn't Mike Quinn draw a direct line saying it was the Salamander letter, and it was this sort of stuff that led him to dive in full and come up with the early Mormonism and the magic worldview, which...
Right. I was one of the readers of that, and we actually took out about a third of the content of that book.
So it would have been even bigger.
Because Hoffman, and we thought some things were too far out, too speculative, too undocumented, and so that book was actually... And he still got a lot of blame for the book anyway.
Yeah.
But that book was, I think, in the works, and we talk about Quinn's reaction to some of the documents. And
so it was already in the works before
In terms of his writing of it, researching of it and stuff
like that. But it certainly made it more timely.
But I think there was initially, I think church leaders' main message to members was, don't depend on historical documents for your faith, so we can see how fallible those documents are. Base your faith on these other things other than history or historical documents, and if you don't, and then don't rely on historians, either. Base your faith on the things we tell you to base it on. I think that was the initial mission.
And
I think Sunstone and Dialogue, I think history writing took a hit early on. I think people, young historians, I think, were given a message that's don't go there. But I think it was overcome in more recent terms. I think the first decade after that, there was sort of a depression, but I think the last decade was much more open. And it's gone. And the electronic age, I think, is a large part of it. Now, anybody interested in the church can research it electronically, and they can find pros, cons, and everything they want to find on the internet now. So I think it's going to be pretty hard to suppress people interested in history.
Yeah. But at the same time, what's missing from at least a lot of these discussions for me is the difference between a sacred narrative and the touchstones and actual fact that you do it. And so often if what we see as the actual historical things don't match up exactly with what is basically a myth, which gives meaning and orientation, and it's geared towards helping you know who you are and your eternal destiny and all that stuff. So the story is obviously shaped, and it's constantly being reshaped, and that's natural, and that's healthy for any community that their sacred story would find its tweaking. And yet, as soon as these factual things come along, so many people say, "Wow, I'm lied to."
But the church isn't depending on intellectuals to make up its core membership. It's really, as we all know, the church membership is now more than 50% non-English speaking,
right,
more than 50% in other countries other than the United States. And the lesson manuals have been simplified, and the church ed people are no longer supposed to participate in Sunstone Symposia.
Right.
There are still some things. The church, I think it was the presiding bishopric's office, sponsored 30 years ago this minimal Mormon study where they were trying to identify what it took to be a Mormon minimally in terms of economic contribution, belief system, knowledge, participation, activity. And they kept narrowing it down. Correlation, I think, was part of the attempt to do that narrowing. So I don't think the church, frankly, cares that much about people whose approach to Mormonism comes from an intellectual foundation. I think they're more interested in the social value, the spiritual values, the basic gospel principles. That's the emphasis.
And so, of course, the Sunday curriculum would be for those things.
Right.
And it's not, it's not a deliberate attempt to hide other things so much as if you're going to get a worship service together.
They know what they want to emphasize, and the details of Mormon history aren't what they want to emphasize.
Right.
So I think there is a deliberate attempt to make it very basic, because if they're taking it to people in Africa and people in South America and so forth, the complexity isn't the rich stuff. I mean, for us, that's part of the richness of it. That really stimulates our our interests. But for a typical person encountering two young missionaries, that's not where it's at.
Yeah.
And back in Liverpool in 1840, I think there was actually, I think it's interesting to compare messages back then with messages now. They didn't really use the Book of Mormon in proselyting in the early days very much either.
Right. So I guess I just wanted to kind of tie it back to this idea of it's hard for us to blame the church for wanting to shape their message a certain way, but I seem like what you're talking about with the more openness and the access to documents and the availability and a book like Richard Bushman's Rough Stone Rolling.
I think it could have gone a lot further than it did. It was very much tame and controlled and conservative.
But still there is a message of, if you want to dive deeper, we're not going to try to block you at every turn here, but please pay attention to all the factors that would go into why a church message would be this way and actual facts.
I would like the church to be even more open and more apologetic about things it should apologize for. I mean, even the Pope, Catholic Pope, has apologized for even this extremely conservative Pope that we have now, has apologized for the child abuse stuff. And they finally let Galileo back into the church. It took him 359 years, but they finally exonerated him for his belief that the earth actually rotates around the sun instead of the other way around. And I think the church could say more about Mountain Meadows and other things. And then it would be said, and life would go on, and people wouldn't continue to criticize him for it. I think the archives could be more open even than they are. There's still certain documents that are not accessible to people, legitimate scholars even, the George Buchanan journals and other things that even the family can't get to. So I think there's still some paranoia on the part of leaders that letting open access to things would be harmful to the church. I mean, it's self-protection. Every organization does this.
Right.
This is organizational behavior 101. It's not just Mormons, it's the Catholics, it's the Chrysler Corporation, it's baseball teams, it's everybody wants to control their history and limit negative perceptions of things. So,
well, Boyd K. Packer says that things happen in the church one of two ways, slowly or not at all. and these things do take time. I'm just greatly heartened by the fact that things are changing. They are becoming more open. People in important positions in the historical department are helping make those things happen, and I see these as very positive changes. And I think the momentum is such that it will continue to be that way. Yeah. And
we're in a trend. The trend is looking towards openness
I think Sunstone Dialogue, groups like that are not appreciated by the church. They would prefer that church ed people and members don't participate, and they've said so, and you know that as well as I do. The proclamation, the fact is that if you added up all the readers of Sunstone Dialogue, Journal of Mormon History, and Signature Books products and put them all together, it's like maybe 30,000 people, and that's like 0.0003 of the church membership. It's infinitesimally small. And so, frankly, I don't think they're too worried about it, but when they make an open proclamation, you know that they're somewhat concerned. And I think the fact that they were willing to buy at least even one controversial document and put it away, that suggests, again, there is a paranoia there. So there's still, I think the resolution between church and faith and church and faith and science issues is still not fully resolved. It's just going to play out forever, probably.
One more thing, and actually this was the third thing I was going to mention, even though I definitely wanted to get into where we just went, was the perception that church leaders obstructed justice during the investigation of the Hoffman thing. How would you describe where that criticism comes from?
Some of the book authors, and there have been some other book, Lindsay's book, Gathering of Saints, and Nafe and Smith's book, The Mormon Murders. Those are two books that came out after ours. They're shorter, and from our book was reviewed by the New York Times Book Reviews, and I've read the other books. I think Lindsay's is a fairly good book. 150 pages. Mormon Murder is not a very good book. They hated Utah and everybody in it, and everybody was a bad guy, even, you know. So I think they implied, if not said directly, that the church obstructed justice, if not conspired to obstruct. We didn't find evidence of that in our research. We did document in here about the early interviews with President Hinckley. He wasn't president, but Counselor Hinckley.
Well, still called president.
Yeah, and how he couldn't remember all of the meetings he had with Hoffman, and he claimed not to keep a day timer, and he didn't remember having many conversations with Steve Christensen. But the police had records of all of that. They had phone records, and so Mike George and Ken Farnsworth and Stott and some of the attorneys, they came out of that very angry because they thought that they were not being dealt with truthfully. But and then when they went to interview the Mormon historians down at BYU, Arrington and others, they felt like they were stonewall error. But that was just at the beginning. I think over time, with repeated follow-up interviews and things, I think the church's involvement became clear, and I think it became clear to the police and to the attorneys prosecuting and to ourselves that there were no conspiracies going on. The church really was initially defensive because they were involved in this, you know, McClellan deal, and there was Pinnock doing something that maybe wasn't totally appropriate as a bank director, as the church leader, and I think there was some idea of maybe protecting him until he found out what was really happening. I think that was pretty natural, not to be totally open, forthcoming. I don't think there was any lying or deception or hiding evidence or anything that could be criminal or even slightly criminal.
I'm just saying, sorry to interrupt, there was a point when Mark Hoffman came to Ballin Oaks. I think it was it the day of the bombings? I can't remember for sure, but he said he thought he was going to be questioned by the authorities, you know, either, I can't remember if it was the police or FBI or someone. And he said, "What should I do?" And he said, and Ballin Oaks said,
Tell the truth. Yeah.
He never told him to hide anything or deceive. You just tell him the truth, whatever it is. And that was very early on.
So I think eventually the church leaders and the historians produced what they were asked to produce. I think there were some subpoenas, though, because I think there was reluctance. I wouldn't confuse reluctance with criminal conspiracy. I think there's a natural reluctance.
Yeah, I want to move on and kind of bring this to a close in the next 10 minutes or so, but what I'm hearing from both of you, who know this story inside out, personal experience with Steve Christensen, to Alan, massive investigations, 400s of interviews, Kurt, being in this world and whatnot. If Mark Hoffman's legacy is people are losing their faith over this, neither of you have, wherever your own faith stands, and maybe we do a separate interviews about your own faith journey someday, it isn't tied to loss of faith over the Mark Hoffman affairs, the conduct of leaders, the issues about Mormon history or whatnot related to the church, or would you
say I got asked that a lot by groups I spoke with and people who I talked to individually. They said, was your faith altered, testimony shattered? And I always had the same answer, which is no, because I'd already come to my conclusions about the church, its history, its theology, its political policies, and everything else. I'd already come to that, as had Linda. So our opinions about the church weren't changed at all. But I know other people who were quite shaken by it. But again, that's because I think they're... I remember as a missionary, somebody saying that your testimony is like a tripod, and one part is your spiritual experience, one part is the social value, and the other part is the empirical, truth-based, you know, history and theology, that part. And you pull one leg out of the triangle or the tripod, and the whole tripod falls. But I know for my parents, for example, I don't think there's any historical document, even if there was a rumor once that I think Hoffman probably circulated that there was a document found in a piano in New York. Have you heard this one? That was a letter from Sidney Rigdon to Joseph Smith where they they conspired to come up with the Book of Mormon as a way of making money.
I don't think I've heard that one.
And Hoffman was on the verge of obtaining it, and again, there was, you know. And so my parents, who are, you know, in their 80s and 90s, there is no historical document that could change their faith, because it's not really based on that. But a lot of other people who are really into the theology and into the history, when they find out that what they were told isn't true, they feel betrayed. And that betrayal can go deeply enough that they can say, this isn't what I signed up for. I thought it was this, and now it's this. So people like that leave the church. And I don't blame them. I don't blame for staying. I don't blame for leaving. I think everybody has to, you know, my kids have all, some are active, some are not, you know. And so I think it's an individual choice. What you think is important about your religion, it could be its history and its theology, or it could be the social value you get out of it and the Beatitudes being trod over the pulpit and in Sunday school class. Maybe that's more important.
I think I was hurt by him for other reasons.
Yeah.
Not my, personal betrayal, the fact that, you know, he lied and deceived and cheated and then ended up killing a friend and a good man that I'd come to admire greatly, and so the damage was, my faith wasn't based on any of that, and I don't base it on any one person, not even Joseph Smith. So, but he hurt a lot of people in a lot of ways, and it's true, a lot of faith has suffered because of that. But I think a lot of that is due to the fact that people don't know their own history or have unrealistic expectations. And ironically, it was while I knew Mark, shortly before that, and the whole time I knew him, that I was becoming more and more aware of our history and studied it in more depth than I ever had. And he and I actually had discussions about a lot of these, you know, the issues of church history and so on. So all during this time, I was, I think you would say that I was, my journey had taken a different turn, perhaps, as I learned more and more, but my faith wasn't based on the history or...
Yeah.
So
I agree with your comment about expectations. I think it's all about that. Any member of any church who believes their leaders are infallible and perfect will be disappointed at some point.
Yeah.
Any member of any church who thinks that their history is completely clean of any problems will be disappointed at some point when they get. And if any person in any church thinks that their theology is foolproof and beyond any criticism or problem, or their social policies even, they're going to be disappointed. So it's about expectation. If you
right.
have reasonable expectations, I think you'll be okay. But if you're, but your point, Dan, was if the church sets up these impossible expectations, the more impossible they are, that you should become perfect, that leaders are perfect, that our history is flawless, that our theology is impeccable. Then, if that's the setup, then if you're a thoughtful member, you're going to get a hit. And then it's a matter of, is your faith based on that, or is it spiritual or something
right.
else?
Right, and I was echoing somebody else. That wasn't necessarily my argument. I was, for the sake of
right.
of a certain segment, that's certainly their claim. And partly what I was trying to do, when you guys both said, if you base your faith on, sometimes people believe too much. But what they believe, the too much that they've put their faith into me, again, is that sacred narrative, the overarching narrative. And so when that is not set up as history, that is set up as sacred story. And if you can kind of understand the dynamics between that and actual events, I think it goes some way to protect you.
Well, and some people live in a really black and white world, and there are a lot of those people in the church that either can't or won't see areas of gray. And I think, if anything, Hoffman taught us that there are wide areas of gray and that things aren't clear. They weren't clear to any of us, including the leaders of our church.
Yeah.
But that's to be expected. And I don't come out of that being terribly surprised by most of the difficulties that the people went through, and the confusion and so on. So again, back to those expectations, if you expect everything to be exactly according to the model you've created, or maybe the church does help create this model. But if you, I think if you quiz any church leaders, none of them is going to tell you that they are perfect or that the prophet is perfect and that the church, they would say, is perfect in its organization and so on. But people aren't, and as I said, we're all humans first and then Mormons or whatever later.
I think other churches, though, do provide models for their leaders that are more human, and they're not so... the Lutherans. Luther was a very flawed guy, despite his many virtues, and Mary Baker Eddy and Ellen White and, you know, the popes. Go look at the popes. And so I think those people don't leave their religions because of the imperfections of their leaders, unless it comes to child abuse or something, right, you know, like that. So I think Mormons are taught. I remember what I was taught, and it was
that they're a different class of human beings.
They're in the spiritual stratosphere, and we need to be too. And so I think that is setting up some people for disappointment. Yeah. So there's a lesson. I think we did learn something from Hoffman. I agree with you about that.
Well, thank you, both of you, for joining us on Mormon Stories. I had asked Kurt to kind of prepare a little bit about the different books that are available out there. We've kind of talked about them. I'm 100% recommending Alan and Linda's book, Salamander. I know it's out of print.
No, it's not.
It's reprinted in paperback.
About 2 years ago, They came out with a 6x9 sized one with a different cover. So this is the third format it's had, and It's pretty bulky. The original, the one I have here, is 556 pages or something, and the other one, the new one, is even thicker because they use different paper. But it's available from you, I think.
Yes.
And maybe Weller has it. I think
I think we're the only ones in the entire world.
The listeners need to go to www.benchmarkbooks.com.
Don't go to Amazon. It'll take weeks. Exactly. You'll have to pay for it.
And you would probably lose your faith if you ordered from them anyway.
There's a cute picture.
The one and only true bookseller is Benchmark. Yeah.
If one had to choose one book to read, and only one, then I would choose Salamander, because I think it does the best job in presenting the story in understandable terms and focusing on the areas that need focusing on, and the story is told well. It's very
wonderful. It's gripping. Crime, yeah.
And, I mean, we could spend 5 minutes just reading the blurbs by critics and others saying, you know, how wonderful it was and so on. I do think, you know, maybe Alan and I disagree a little bit. I do think it's important to read Victims by Richard Turley, because...
I think it's important to read it, and because you get the church's perspective.
Exactly. He did have access to a lot of material that nobody else did. I think Rick tried to be as fair as he could. I know Alan sees a little more as maybe as apology or defense, but it's an enormously important book to... In fact, I recommend that people read Salamander and Victims, and I wouldn't hesitate to tell them to read A Gathering of Saints by Robert Lindsay as well. I think, for an outsider especially, I think he did a good job. He could have, you know, I'm sure that if he spent more time, he might have been able to do a little more in depth, but I think it's a credible job. He's
insightful. He's a stringer, New York Times stringer out of San Francisco, and he wrote Falcon and the Snowman, which became a movie. So I respect his work.
And he tried to be very... I mean, he interviewed me at length, and many others. I think he did everything he could to look into it and to do an in-depth job in research, and he's an excellent writer.
Yes.
And then, as you said, The Mormon Murders is a terrible book.
Nafai and Smith.
Nafai and Smith.
And then Simon Worrell did a crazy one.
The Poet and the Murderer. I think his Mormon history part of that book is terrible.
Yeah, the Tanners wrote something as well.
Tracking the White Salamander.
Their version of it, which probably is hard to, you know, you can probably get it directly from them, and that's the only way you can get it. And then Throckmorton's small book on kind of his theory as to why Hoffman was motivated to do the bombings. I don't remember the name of that.
Motive for Murder. Maybe, I think. Yeah.
The Bombs, the Mormons, and the Salamander.
No, well, I think it's Motive for Murder. Gary Sheets even did a book. With somebody else in the form of a novel about his life, but it includes a lot on there. There have been a number of things, but I think the ones we've mentioned, especially the first three, are certainly the most important and the best.
Cool. Great. Well, on this 25th anniversary, I hope you listeners have enjoyed our conversation. I'm not sure we told the tale in the most linear way, and I hope that you weren't lost too many times. But
it's
I think we got to the key issues, and it is a complex.
Read the books.
Right before we published, we cut out 100 pages and another 100 characters,
wow,
and another 100 documents. I mean, otherwise it would have been 700 pages with another zillion documents and people, and we found there were so many people that a lot of them had the same name. Two people, like there were two detectives called Don Bell, and two Jeff Saltz, and two, you know, and there were like four pairs of people. When we got to that point, we thought nobody's going to keep this straight without like the biggest scorecard in the world. So we simplified it, and it's still very complicated, and it's still playing out. I mean, this new document.
I was just about to mention the 3 weeks ago from when we're recording this, a soul to say in early September. Mountain Meadows document related to, you know, it wasn't one that changed or altered the history or anything, but again, it's one that's quoted even in the Turley, the church's book on Mountain Meadows Massacre, on the Will Bagley one on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, this Hoffman forgery that has just been determined in the last few weeks.
I should read you the last paragraph of Salamander, because it says summary, and this is really Throckmorton writing. He says, during the 1.5 year investigation in the Mark Hoffman documents, more than 6,000 documents, reportedly dating from 1792 to 1929, were examined. Of that total, 443 documents came from Hoffman. Okay, so let's just deal with those. Of these, 268, or 60%, were found to be authentic, mostly public court records and other historically insignificant items. Another 68 documents, or 15%, could not be proven either genuine or forged. However, 107 documents, or 24%, were found to be forged. And these were the documents with the highest dollar value, and they had the most controversial content, and some Americana, some Mormon content. And this was in 1988. Well, since then, Throckmorton has been asked to look at many, many scores of other documents, of which this new one is just an example. So, I mean, Hoffman was at it for a long time, and I think they'll keep coming out and surfacing. But I think on an American level, document dealers across the country and even internationally now are more wary, more careful, do more tests, because you never know when another Hoffman's going to surface.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid the legend and the legacy of Mark Hoffman are going to continue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good note to end it on, again, though, with a reminder that whatever you hear a term like legend or master forger or something like that, this all came from a person who was a sociopath, a black heart, and he killed two great people and wounded psychologically and financially and PR-wise and everything, so many people in a very negative way. And I think we all wish that this episode never happened. But it's important to understand it, and it's important for you as listeners and people who may be coming to Mormon studies for early in your career. It's good to get a feel for this, so I'm really grateful for both of you spending the time with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.